Now, I'd advise you to pass on my orders to her and let her decide." He punched off the phone, terminating the call. He knew what she would do. She trafficked in death for a living and feared little, but she feared Lucan. They'd had a liaison a few years past. She knew his true nature. She would obey. He rubbed his jaw, eyes narrowed. Samhain was too swift approaching. For the first time in centuries he felt a whisper of unease. He'd been untouchable, virtually invincible for so long that he didn't quite recognize the feeling. At least he knew exactly where the mirror was. That alleviated much of his unease. Still, if it weren't in his possession within a very short time, he would have no choice but to go after it himself. He greatly preferred not to. On those rare occasions he'd freed the Keltar from the dark glass. He'd stayed on heavily warded ground that had neutralized the Highlander's immense power until the mirror had safely reclaimed its captive. The complex, intense warding necessary to keep Kian McKelter's power suppressed required painstaking ritual and time. Could he and his men manage to ward the university's grounds around the mirror? Possibly. It would be risky. Many things could go wrong. They could be seen. There could be other magic, both old and new, on the grounds that might create conflicts. People didn't know it, but magic was all around them. Always had been. Always would be. It merely concealed itself with greater sophistication now than it had in days of yore. Dare he confront the Highlander with his full powers intact on unwarded ground? Surely, after 1,000 years, he'd surpassed Kian McKelter, and was the greater sorcerer at last. He turned away from the windows, wishing he felt certain of that. It had not been his superior sorcery that had put the Keltar where he was. It had been well-played deceit and treachery. Perhaps the Keltar hadn't been freed. Perhaps Roman had fallen prey to another assassin. They did that sometimes, went after each other for money or glory or the challenge of it. He'd know for certain in a day or two. Then he'd decide upon his next move. Kian stood, hands fisted at his sides, waiting. He'd known she would return. She was no fool. She'd been wise enough to identify the mirror as her most effective weapon when Roman had threatened her. He'd not doubted she'd see the wisdom of his offer. He'd just not been certain how long it might take her, and time was everything to him now. 20 days. 'Twas all he needed from her. 'Twas not, by far, all he wanted from her. All he wanted from her would bring a blush to the cheeks of even the most practiced whore. Standing a few feet beyond his prison, staring at him, her dark green eyes were huge, her lips softly parted, and those dream-come-true breasts were rising and falling with each anxious breath she drew. He couldn't wait to taste them, rub back and forth, teasing her nipples with heated swirls and flicks of his tongue, suckle her. Firm and deep. Breasts like that made a man want babes at them. His babes. But not too often, or there'd not be time enough for him. He tossed his head, beaded braids clattering metallically, drawing tight rein on his lustful thoughts. The moment she summoned him forth, he would use voice on her. His skin was crawling with the need to escape the place Lucan surely knew he was by now. He'd killed the assassin in the wee hours of Tuesday morn. A full 24 hours had passed since then. Though he'd not walked free in the world for longer than he cared to recall, from his purloined books and papers and view in Lucan's study, he had a fair notion of the weft and weck of the modern world. It was both horrifyingly larger and shockingly smaller than ever it had been, with billions of people. Even a Keltar druid felt a measure of awe at those kinds of numbers. Yet telephones that could span continents in mere moments, computers that could instantly retrieve all manner of information and connect people on opposite poles, and airplanes that could bridge continents in under a day. It was confounding. It was fascinating. It meant they had to move. Now. Voice, the druid art of compulsion, was one of his greatest talents. As a stripling lad on the verge of manhood, the time of life when a Keltar's powers became apparent and often fluctuated wildly while developing. For nigh a week he'd strolled about the castle using voice on all and sundry, without realizing it. He'd caught on only because he'd grown suspicious as to why everyone kept scrambling to please him. He'd learned to be careful, to listen to his own tones for that unique layering of voices. Only a bumbling fool or a novice with a death wish wielded magic inadvertently. When free of the mirror, on unwarded ground, there was none alive but Lucan himself who could withstand his command of voice, and only because 'twas Kian who'd taught the bastard the art. In the practice of druidry, mentor and pupil developed resistance to each other during the process of training. She would heal nicely. Women did. It wasn't their fault nature had designed them to be so malleable. They were softer all around. He would command her to lead him to a safe place where they could go to ground. And once there, oh, once there, he had centuries of unsated lust for things other than vengeance. And this woman with her ripe curves and creamy skin and tangle of short, glossy hair was the answer to all of them. What better way to spend the final 20 days of his indenture than feeding his every sexual hunger, indulging his deepest desires and most carnal fantasies with this sensual delicacy of a woman? At that moment, the sensual delicacy of a woman notched her chin up. Stubbornly. There might even have been a glint of fire in her eyes.
"I'm not letting you out until you answer a few questions," she informed him coolly.
He snorted with impatience, of all the moments for her to get contrary. Women certainly knew how to pick them.
"Wench, we have no time for this. Lucan has no doubt already dispatched another assassin who is drawing ever nearer as we speak."
"Lucan?"
she pounced.
"Is that who wants the mirror back?"
"Aye."
"Lucan who?"
He shifted his weight from foot to foot, crossed his arms.
"Why, you think you might know him?"
he snapped sardonically, one dark brow arching. When her nostrils flared and her chin tipped higher, he sighed and said,
"Ah, Trevane. His name is Lucan Trevane."
"Who and what are you?"
"You called my name when you released me the first time," he said impatiently. "'Tis Kian MacKeltar. As for the what of me, I'm but a man."
"The blonde man said you were a murderer."
Her voice was poison apple sweet.
"Remember him? The one you murdered?"
"Ach," he said indignantly, "and there's the pot calling the kettle black."
"He said you were locked away for the safety of the world."
"Hardly. Your world, Jessica, would be far safer with me in it."
"So why are you in a mirror?"
She brightened, as if at a sudden cheerful thought.
"Are you like a genie? Can you grant wishes?"
"If you mean a djinn, even the feeblest of bamparts know they do not exist. Nay, I donna grant wishes."
"Yeah, well, everyone also knows men in mirrors don't exist, so how did you come to be in one?"
"I was tricked. How else would a man end up in a mirror?"
"How were you tricked?"
"'Tis a long story."
When she opened her mouth to press, he said flatly,
"And not one of which I care to speak, leave me."
Her eyes narrowed like a cat's.
"That blonde man also said the mirror was an unseelie piece. I looked up unseelie on the net. It's not a classification of artifact. It's a classification of fairy."
She sneered the word.
"What, I ask you, am I supposed to make of that?"
"That is an exceedingly rare artifact," he suggested lightly. "Woman, we've no time to discuss such matters now. I'll answer all your questions once you've freed me and we're on the move."
The lie spilled easily from his tongue. He would silence her concerns with a simple command laced with voice the moment she let him out. He planned to immediately toss a few other commands her way as well. He was a man who'd been without a woman far too long, and his hunger was immense. Contemplating the erotic orders he would give her, stiffened his cock and drew his testicles tight.
"Bring that sweet ass over here, Jessica. Open that lovely mouth of yours and lick this. Turn around, woman, and let me fill my hands with those splendid breasts while I bend you over the—"
"Why would someone want to trick you into a mirror?"
Jarred from the lustful stupor of his thoughts, he stepped back, drawing silver around his lower body to conceal the rising of his kilt. He doubted such blatant proof of his intentions would serve as persuasion to free him. Bloody hell, he should have used voice to get himself some modern clothing when he dispatched Roman the other eve. Those tight blue jeans both men and women favored would likely hold down a shaft of even his size.
"Because by binding me to it, the one who tricked me gained immortality. Each unseelie relic offers a dark power of some sort. Living forever, never aging, never changing, is the dark glass's gift," he growled.
By Danu, what was it going to take to get her to let him out of the blethering glass?
"Oh."
She stared at him blankly for a moment.
"So let me get this straight. You're telling me that not only are there people inside mirrors and fairies somewhere busily crafting artifacts endowed with paranormal attributes, but there are also immortals skulking around my world?"
He nearly snarled aloud with frustration.
"I very much doubt they skulk, woman, and to the best of my knowledge, the Fae haven't crafted aught in millennia, not since they withdrew to their hidden realms. And do not be facetious, I'm merely answering your questions."
"Impossible answers."
"Does not the maxim still hold that once a thing occurs, 'tis impossible? 'Tis impossible, ergo, 'tis possible."
"I've never seen an immortal, and I've certainly never seen a fairy."
"You split hairs. You've seen me, and best hope you never do see either of them."
"Why?"
"Jessica,"
he said softly, menacingly, infusing her name with the promise of infinite dangers.
"I am going to count to three. If you permit me to reach that number without having begun the chant to release me, I will rescind my offer. I will not so much as lift a finger when the next killer comes for you. I will sit back and watch you die a slow and heinous death. I'm beginning now. One. Two."
"There's no need to get pissy,"
she said pissily.
"I planned to say it. I just wanted to clear a few things up first."
"Three."
"All right, I'm saying it. I'm saying it. Lialp, Bray, Chebray."
"Bloody hell, wench, finally!"
Chapter 7
"Kian Mekeltar, Drachme Seishie."
Jessie finished breathlessly. Heart hammering inside her chest, she eased back nervously, her gaze riveted to the mirror. The silver went smoky and dark, boiling with shadows like a doorway opening onto a storm. Then the black stain around the edges expanded, swallowing up the entire surface. Simultaneously, golden light blazed from within the engravings on the frame, painting fiery runes across her clothing, the furniture, the walls of the office. The disconcerting sensation of spatial distortion in the room increased to a nails-on-a-chalkboard degree, rasping over her nerve endings. Then, as abruptly as it had begun, the light dimmed and the black cleared, revealing a watery silver that rippled and danced like the surface of Lake Michigan on a windy day. One booted foot pushed through, then a powerful thigh as the one-dimensional image crossed some kind of fairy-tale threshold and transformed from a mere reflection into a three-dimensional man, bit by bit. It was impossible. It was terrifying. It was the most thrilling thing she'd ever seen. Out came those kilt-clad hips, that six-pack abdomen, followed by his sculpted upper body rippling with those wicked-looking crimson and black tattoos. Last came that sinfully gorgeous dark face, his white teeth flashing in an exultant smile, his whiskey eyes glittering with triumph. He gave a regal, full of himself, toss of his head, beaded braids tinkling as he fully exited the mirror. The sensation of spatial distortion eased, and the glass went flat silver again, reflecting his tight ass and beautifully muscled back. Jessie braced herself, trying to console herself with the thought that if she was going to die now, at least she'd gotten one final heaping helping of eye candy. This man belonged in the RBL Romantica Bra and Bonnie Beefcake Farm. Criminy, this man probably owned the farm, or if not, had stood stud to the mothers of half the other members. Though he'd looked massive enough inside the glass, outside it, he seemed even larger. The man had presence, that elusive quality that made some people lodestones, drawing others, even against their will. And he knew it. From the looks of him, he'd always known it. Arrogant, cocky prick. But was he a murderous one? That was the important question.
If you're going to kill me, I'd
Cease speaking, wench! You will bring that sweet ass over here and kiss me now.
Jessie gaped, mouth open mid-word, snapped her mouth closed, opened it again. Her head suddenly itched just beneath the skin, above her metal plate. She rubbed at her scalp.
As if!
She meant to hiss it indignantly, but it came out more of a squeak. Sweet ass. He thought she had a sweet ass. They could form a mutual admiration society of two.
Remove that woolen woman and show me your breasts.
Choking on an inhalation, she sputtered for several seconds. Numerous were the men who'd tried to go there. Even she knew she had exceptional breasts, but none quite so obviously and without exerting even an ounce of seductive effort. She clamped her hands over them defensively.
Oh, I so don't think that's going to
Cease speaking!
He roared.
You will not speak again unless I tell you to.
Jessie drew back like a cobra, scratching her scalp again. He couldn't be serious. He certainly looked like he was. After a moment's stunned silence, in a voice sweet enough to cause cavities in porcelain caps, she said,
You can go fuck yourself, you great, big, domineering Neanderthal. Wake up, call. Guess what? We're not in the Stone Age anymore.
As I pointed out earlier, a physical impossibility, and I ken full well what epoch it is.
Come here, Jessica St. James. No.
Jessie blinked at him. A sudden thought occurred to her, one that would explain much about this man.
How long have you been inside that mirror?
She demanded. A muscle worked in his jaw.
I told you to cease speaking.
Despite his persistent asininity, her temper was decreasing as her suspicion that she was correct was increasing.
Well, duh, clearly I'm not going to, so you may as well answer my question.
His eyes narrowed. That whiskey gaze swept her from head to toe intently.
1133 years.
Whoa. She sucked in an astounded breath. That would place him in... No, the 9th century? No way. A living, breathing 9th century man, right here in front of her, somehow trapped in an ancient relic and cast forward 11 centuries? Chills rippled across every square inch of her skin. Even the hair on her head felt as if it were trying to rise.
Really?
She nearly squealed the word. She was so delighted. The remnants of her hot temper collapsed into a pile of ash. Oh, the things he might be able to tell her! Had the legendary King Kened Mac Alpin been his contemporary? Had he lived through those mighty battles? Had he seen the unification of the Scots and Picts? Were those incredible wrist cuffs genuine 9th century work? What were those tattoos, anyway? And those runes on the mirror, was it possible they comprised a previously undiscovered language? Holy shit! For that matter, was it really from the Stone Age? How could that be? Where had it come from? Who'd made it? What was it made of? Now that she'd conceded the reality of his existence, she had a gazillion questions about it. They all collided in her mind, getting tangled up in one another, and she ended up gaping at him in stunned silence. It took her several moments to realize that he was regarding her with exactly the same expression, as if he couldn't quite believe she existed. There they stood, in Professor Keene's office, 10 feet separating them, each eyeing the other with blatant incredulity and suspicion. Now that was just silly. What could he possibly find hard to believe about her?
"Say my name, wench," he thundered.
She shook her head, stupefied by all her questions, befuddled by his request.
"Kian McKelter, why?"
He looked mildly appeased, then suspicious again.
"Scratch your nose, woman."
"It doesn't itch."
"Stand on one foot."
She wrinkled her nose at him.
"You stand on one foot."
"Bloody hell," he breathed, as if to himself.
"It can't be."
He gave her that intent scan from head to toe again, seemed to hold a brief but heated inner discourse with himself, then nodded toward the desk.
"Go sit in that chair."
"I don't feel like it. I'm perfectly happy standing right where I am, thank you."
"Moisten your lips."
His gaze fixed on her mouth. It took considerable effort not to moisten them while he was looking at them like that. It made her fixate on his own incredibly kissable mouth, made her want to not only wet her lips, but pucker up and hike her sweet ass right over there. Maybe even show him her breasts after all. She was appalled at the indiscriminatory nature of hormones, how awful that it was possible to actively dislike a man, have nothing in common with him, including not even existing in the same world, and still want to tear his clothes off and have hot animal sex with him. Stoically, she resisted.
"What's your deal?"
"Christ," he whispered slowly. "I've been in there for so long, I've lost it."
"Lost what? Oh, you mean your mind. Yeah, well, not going to argue with you there."
He stared at her a long moment in silence, frowning. Then his brow eased and his eyes cleared.
"Nay, my mind is still as extraordinarily superior as it has always been. No matter. There's more than one way to skin a cat."
God, he was arrogant. She marveled at the sheer, unmitigated cockiness of the man. Had all 9th-century men been that way? In retrospect, it occurred to her that she should have seen it coming. She was, after all, a fan of history, a studier of mankind, a ponderer of ancient civilizations. She knew what life had been like 1,000 years ago for women. Men had been men, and women had been property. And somehow she still managed to be utterly unprepared when he ducked that sexy, dark head of his and charged her.
"Oof!"
Jesse grunted as his shoulder made contact with her stomach. Her feet left the ground, her world tilted precariously, and the next thing she knew, she was hanging upside down over his shoulder. One of his muscle-bound arms banded her waist, pinning her to his shoulder. The other hand splayed firmly on her bottom. She parted her lips and was just about to let loose a screech that would do a banshee proud, when his hand moved, possessively, intimately, dipping right between her legs. He pressed strong fingers against the opening of her vulva through her jeans, his thumb expertly finding her clitoris at the same time. Fire exploded red hot inside her. Her mouth, open on an intended shriek of rage, released a soft, stunned exhalation of air instead. His big warm hand rested there a moment, applying a firm but gentle, relentless pressure, enough to bring every nerve ending brutally to life and awaken an aching hunger deep within her womb. He said nothing. She said nothing either, mostly because, at the moment, all she could think of to say was, "Excuse me, but your hand seems to have slipped between my legs. And if you'll move it just the tiniest bit, I bet I could come." His hand was gone. It returned, lower, bending her to him by the backs of her knees. Reason returned also, accompanied by Fury. The sad part was that what he'd just done had made her so instantly, incredibly horny that she wasn't sure if she was more furious at him for doing it in the first place, or for stopping when he had. And that made her even more furious still.
"Put me down,"
she managed to hiss. So maybe it came out a bit more breathy than sibilant, but it was the best she could do upside down with her boobs in her face.
"Hold your wisht, woman."
"Hold my what?"
"It means hush, Jessica, just hush. Would it kill you to hush?"
"Probably," she snapped. "Put me down, I can walk."
"Nay, I've no desire for you to be master of your destiny in any manner, however small. You are too unpredictable."
"I'm unpredictable."
"Aye."
She was speechless a moment. Then she pinched his butt, hard.
"Ow!"
He smacked her bottom.
"Ow!"
she yelped.
"Behave!"
he growled.
"Tit for tat, lass. Remember that."
The arm banding her waist relaxed. He repositioned her on his shoulder, then tightened his grip again, making her realize she probably couldn't get off his shoulder if her life depended on it. That single muscle-bound arm was as unyielding as reinforced steel. The abruptness with which he shifted her jostled her backpack, still looped over her shoulders. Crammed with purse, laptop, assorted notepads, pens, pencils, and a 4-inch-thick Ancient Civilizations textbook, it yielded to gravity, slid down, and thumped her in the back of the head. Hard.
"Ow!"
she yelled again.
"Shit! Put me down this instant, you brute!"
"Unbelievable,"
she thought she heard him mutter.
"Oh, you think so?" she snarled. "I'm the one flung over a primate's shoulder. You're the primate. I'm the one entitled to be saying unbelievable, not you."
"Unbelievable,"
he muttered again. He spun about so quickly that she nearly puked the 5 extra cups of coffee she hadn't really wanted, but had drunk anyway in the cafe earlier, all over that magnificent butt she'd just pinched. And yes, like his arm, the man had buns of steel. Plucking up the massive mirror, he tucked it beneath the arm he'd freed by shifting her, and turned for the door. Woman on one side, artifact on the other, not even straining. And she knew how heavy that mirror was. The 2 deliverymen had wrestled with its weight. Stalking out into the corridor, he demanded,
"Which way?"
She raised her head for as much clearance as she could gain with 38 pounds of backpack. She'd weighed it once so she could factor the toting about of it into her daily caloric intake. It had earned her 2 Krispy Kremes every other morning, resting against her skull.
"Why should I tell you?"
she said snottily. He bit her hip.
"Left,"
she gritted. He turned left and took off at a trot. The strain on her neck was too much. She put her head back down. Her breasts were in her face, and as she bounced against his back with each step he took, her backpack thunked her steadily in the back of the head. At least her face was cushioned against the repeated blows. She wasn't getting her nose hammered rat-a-tat-tat into his spine. Thank God for small blessings. Or 2 large ones, as the case may be.
"Where are you taking me?"
she mumbled against her sweater.
"I am taking you to whatever manner of transportation you have. You are then taking us to procure suitable lodgings."
"I am."
"If you wish to live."
She wished. She mumbled directions to the lot in which her car was parked.
"You're mumbling, lass."
She mumbled again.
"What was that?"
she mumbled again.
"Did you just say something about your breasts?"
he said warily. A pause, then a reverent,
"Oh, Christ, they're in your face!"
He stopped so abruptly her backpack thumped the back of her head in double time, a soft whomp, followed by a solid thwack, dazing her. When she felt his chest shaking, it took her a few moments to identify the motion. He was laughing. The rat bastard was laughing.
"I so hate you,"
she told her breasts, meaning not them, of course, but him. As he continued to laugh, the fight went out of her, up in a puff of smoke. She was tired, she was freaked out, and she really just wanted to walk on her own 2 feet.
"Would you please put me down?"
she said plaintively. She suspected he must have felt the diminishing of tension in her muscles, read her body language, and knew mentally she'd capitulated. His laughter subsided. He bent and gently deposited her on her feet. His scotch-gold gaze glittered with amusement and sexual heat he made no effort to disguise.
"Better."
He cupped her chin with one big hand, thumb brushing her lower lip. She twisted her face away.
"Better. Come on, let's get out of here before someone sees us with the professors."
"What the hell do you think you're doing, Jess?" Mark Trudeau barked sharply behind her. Jessie turned disbelievingly. What? Had the mere thought been a self-fulfilling prophecy? Mark's office was a few hundred feet down the hall from Professor Keene's. When she'd passed it earlier, there'd been no lights on. Didn't he have a life? What was he doing here so late? Was nothing going to go right anymore? Great. Just great. This was just what she needed. Mark running off to tattle to anyone who would listen that not only had she crossed police lines and gone into the professor's office, but she'd made off with a priceless, mysterious artifact. If the police did the least bit of checking into things, they would discover that what she'd taken was what the murdered deliveryman had delivered to the murdered professor. And she would be oh so incriminatingly on the lam, nowhere to be found, last seen in the company of a tall, dark, kilt-clad stranger, stealing the fabulously expensive black market relic that 3 people had already died over. Without getting the slightest chance to tell her side of the story and point out that somebody'd tried to murder her, too. As if anyone would believe her anyway. Shit, shit, shit. When all this was over, she really wanted to be able to finish her degree at the university where she'd begun it, not via correspondence courses from jail. That kind of stuff just didn't look good on a resume.
"Oh, for crying out loud, Mark, it's 2 in the morning. What are you doing here?"
"I believe I just asked you that." Close-set brown eyes behind rimless glasses darted from her to the half-naked, towering man toting the mirror, and back to her again. What could she say? Dredging her mind, she drew an empty net. Try though she might, she couldn't think of a single excuse for her current circumstances, convincing or otherwise. She would have been grateful even for an absurd one, but apparently her brain was done for the day. As she stood there, staring at him like the biggest idiot, Kian McKelter took care of the problem.
"You will go back in that room from whence you came, and remain in there silent until well after we've gone. Now."
Mark turned and cantered dutifully back down the hall toward his office without so much as a neigh of protest.
"Wow."
Jesse blinked up at Kian McKelter. He murmured softly, staring after the retreating grad student.
"Mayhap 'tis only her."
"Her? Do you mean me? What me?"
Jesse said expectantly.
"Puny little man,"
he scoffed, as Mark obediently closed the door.
Was that it?
Was that why Mark had slunk off? Because he was puny and Kian McKelter was so big and forbidding? She tipped her head back, eyeing him. At 6.5 feet, and a good 200+ pounds of pure muscle, he dwarfed people. With those wild dark braids tangling halfway down his back, and those wicked red and black tattoos licking across his chest, up to the edge of that whisker-shadowed jaw, he looked downright primeval, an ancient, deadly warrior stalking the halls of the university. She supposed his mere appearance might have been enough to make Mark decide he clearly wouldn't be winning any arguments with this man, so there was little point in beginning any. How nice it must be to have such an impact on the world. If reincarnation was the way of things, she wanted to come back as Kian McKelter. She'd like to be the asshole man for a change, rather than subject to asshole men's dictates. And if she were going to be the asshole man,
She'd like to do it upright and be the biggest and baddest.
That was amazing,
she said fervently.
He is such a pain in the butt. I can't tell you how many times I've wished I could get him to just go away like that. Like he had no choice but to obey me or something.
Come, Jessica.
Kian McKelter closed a hand around her upper arm.
We must away ourselves.
They awayed. Chapter 8. An hour later, they pulled under the canopy of the Sheraton in downtown Chicago. Jesse had wanted to go home and get a few things, but Kian McKelter had immediately, vehemently, vetoed that.
The next assassin could already be awaiting you there, woman,
he'd said, and she'd shivered. How creepy to think that someone might even now be lurking in her dark apartment, waiting to kill her. How odd to think she couldn't go home. Maybe not for a long, long time. Maybe never again. This was it, she'd realized while driving. She'd gone too far to turn back now. She was officially on the run. Her situation wouldn't have been so dire if Mark hadn't caught her leaving with the artifact. But he had. That milk was spilt, and there was no point crying over it. She glanced over at Kian, barely able to see him over the top of the huge mirror that was wedged sideways between the bucket seats of her car. A good quarter of the mirror was hanging out the open hatchback, which was bungeed carefully around it with various bits of her clothing, jackets and sweaters and T-shirts that tended to accumulate in her car as the seasons changed, wedged protectively between metal and glass. Head flush to the ceiling, he looked miserably uncomfortable. It had been as difficult to cram him into the tiny car as it had been to finesse in the mirror. They'd argued over the top of the looking glass the entire way downtown. He took backseat driving to a whole new level.
Ceasing movement so abruptly. Christ, woman, must you catapult forward after each cessation? Are you certain you've strapped the mirror securely? We should stop and check it. By Danu, wench, try nudging this beast gently, not kicking it with both heels.
A silence, a slew of choked curses, then.
Horses! What the bloody hell is wrong with horses? Have they all been slain in battle?
When she finally cranked up her favorite Godsmack CD in an effort to tune him out, he'd let out a roar that had rattled the windows in her car.
By all that's holy, woman, what is that hideous noise? Cease and desist. A battlefield at full charge could be no more cacophonous.
Huh. She loved Godsmack. The man clearly had no taste in music. Scowling, she'd stuffed in Mozart's Requiem, which she reserved for only her broodiest days, usually during finals week. And in moments, he'd been whistling cheerfully along. Cheerfully. Go figure.
You're going to have to stay here, she informed him. I'll get the room and come back for you.
I do not think so,
he growled.
You don't look like the rest of us.
Nay, he agreed. I am bigger, stronger, better.
The look she gave him said she had something nasty on her tongue and couldn't scrape it off.
That's not what I meant. There's no way we'll be able to keep a low profile with you walking around dressed like that.
Leave it to me, woman.
Before she could utter another word, he grappled with the handle, opened the door, and stepped out. Or rather, uncramped and unfolded himself onto the pavement, closing the door behind him. For a man from the 9th century, he sure seemed to know a lot about modern-day things, she mused, though it seemed to be from having observed them, not from having interacted with them. When he'd first gotten in, he'd examined everything, twisting knobs and pushing buttons. He'd even eyed the steering wheel consideringly. Fortunately, he'd seemed to think better of it. Unfortunately, she didn't think his restraint would last long. He liked to be the one in charge.
You will not look at me,
she heard him say to the valets.
You will see only her.
A silence, then.
And you will not look at her breasts.
Jessie blinked and burst out laughing. The man was such a Neanderthal. Like her breasts were his or something. What did he think? That the valets would just dutifully obey him as Mark had? She had news for him. He wasn't that impressive.
"You're not that impressive,"
she said, stepping from the car and casting a dry look across the roof. Five valets stood around the car, looking at her, and only at her, and only at her face.
"May we take your luggage, ma'am?"
one of them said, looking her dead in the eye. Men rarely did that, at least not at first. She smoothed her pink sweater down and took a slow, luxuriatingly deep breath. That always worked. Five gazes remained fixed on her face. She glanced down. They were still there, round and perky and obvious as ever. Mystified, she said,
"No luggage,"
and removed her car key from the key ring. Kian moved to the rear of the car and began unstrapping the mirror.
"We can't take that in with us."
Belatedly, she realized it would have been much smarter to go to some seedy no-tell motel way out on the outskirts. But the Sheraton down on the lake was the only hotel she'd ever stayed in, during an archaeology seminar last summer. And when they'd left campus, she'd headed for it, driving on a sort of bemused autopilot, far too busy defending her driving skills to be thinking clearly. Getting him into a room without causing a memorable stir was going to be difficult enough. They needed to be inconspicuous. Taking the mirror in with them just wasn't possible. Then again, she thought, frowning, they could hardly leave it in the car, either. Again, he merely said,
"Leave it to me, woman."
It was then that she realized, with a sinking sensation in the pit of her stomach, that it was only a matter of time before the police came and arrested her. As if a grim portent, a few blocks down the street a police siren began to sound. She shivered. Oh yeah, only a matter of time. He still had it. Bloody hell, he still had it. There was nothing wrong with him. There was something wrong with her. Mirror beneath one arm, the other wrapped around his woman, he steered her into the brilliantly lit, polished, and gleaming lodgings. Christ, it felt good to walk free. And to walk free with such a beautiful woman on his arm, 'twas heaven to be alive. Even hunted, even knowing what lay ahead, 'twas far more than he'd thought he'd get at such a late hour in the game. Her city seemed much like what he'd seen of London, with insignificant differences, both enormous, both massively populated, frenetic with cars and people rushing to and fro. But her city had taller buildings than aught he'd glimpsed from Lucan's study. He continued tossing out commands in voice as they strode into the lodgings she'd selected.
"Do not look at us. Move out of my way. Do not notice the mirror. We are not here."
Memory spells were extremely complicated and could cause terrible, irreversible damage if done wrong. 'Twas easier to turn eyes away than attempt to make people forget. Still, nonspecific commands such as, "We are not here," weren't truly effective. They served mostly to gloss things over a bit, make events seem dimmer. For voice to be truly compelling, the commands needed to be concise, precise. Commands too vague or complicated could get messy. Orders strongly counter to a person's fundamental beliefs could cause intense pain.
"Why don't you just stand here and I'll go get a room?"
She tipped her head back and looked up at him.
"And you don't have to hold on to me,"
she added peevishly.
"I don't have anywhere else to go."
He smiled. He liked that.
"Where?"
"Where what?"
"Where does one get a room?"
"Oh, over there," she pointed. "Wait here."
"You will cease attempting to give me orders, wench."
He tried voice on her again, thinking perchance something in their earlier environment had conflicted with his use of magic.
"You will cease ordering me to cease giving you orders,"
she said exasperatedly.
"I'm just trying to help."
"The day I need help seeing to the needs of a woman is the day I may as well be dead."
She gave him a measuring look.
"Actually, it'd be nice if more men felt that way. Of course, you still need to lose that whole me Tarzan you Jane thing."
He had no idea what she was havering about, but it didn't matter. What mattered was the getting of a room. He escorted her where she'd pointed, guest check-in, and propped the mirror carefully against the short wooden wall. A trim, auburn-haired 40-ish man with a bristly mustache came over, looking as if he'd rather be anywhere else at this hour.
"You will give us a room, now, and stop looking at me!"
Beside him, Jessica said hastily,
"You'll have to excuse him. He can be a bit oh, for heaven's sake!"
She changed both sentence and direction of her gaze midstream, frowning up at him when the desk clerk obediently, and without protest whatsoever, averted his eyes and began processing the paperwork for a room.
"People keep obeying you like you're some kind of, well, God or something."
"Imagine that. In my day, lass, I was," he thought.
"I can't."
"I'm excruciatingly aware of that," he said dryly.
"Well, why do they keep doing it?"
"Mayhap, woman, they recognize a man among men."
He couldn't resist provoking her.
"That would be man, with a capital M."
She rolled her eyes, as he'd known she would. He bit back a smile. There was no point in explaining to her about voice. She wouldn't understand. The wench was infuriatingly immune, impossibly immune. His amusement faded. He narrowed his eyes, studying her for the 100th time, trying to discern something, anything different about her that might explain her condition. He couldn't discern a blethering thing. Of all the wenches the fates might have appointed to serve as his reluctant savior, the humorless bitches had sent him the only woman he'd ever encountered that he couldn't control.
"I'll just need a credit card,"
the man behind the counter was saying. Kian opened his mouth to use voice again, but Jessica was already handing the man something. He had no idea what it was. He shrugged. He didn't mind letting her feel useful. He knew women liked to feel important, too. 'Twas but that he preferred to make them feel important in other ways. Like as women, in his bed, while he was inside them. And this one, oh, this one did something strange to him, a subtler version of that electrifying jolt he'd felt the first time she'd touched him had been happening each time he touched her. It made it nigh impossible to keep his hands off her. The entire time she'd been over his shoulder, he'd felt a gentle current sizzling through the length and breadth of his body. Wherever their bodies were touching, he felt as if heat lightning crackled just beneath his skin. And he knew, though she pretended otherwise, that she felt it too. When he'd put his hand so blatantly on her woman's mound, he'd been prepared for indignation, outrage, a fierce tongue-lashing. He deserved it. He'd never treated a woman in such a possessive fashion, at least not until after they'd become lovers, bypassing any pretense of civility or seduction entirely. And yet, somehow, at the same time, he'd known she wouldn't lambaste him. It was as if his hand simply belonged there on her, and she knew it too.
"You're getting fanciful, Keltar. Next you'll be thinking she's your one true mate."
According to Keltar legend, each druid born into the clan was destined for a soulmate, a perfect match in heart and mind, as well as body, coming together with an explosive, incendiary passion that could not be denied. If the Keltar male exchanged the sacred druid binding vows with his true love, and his mate willingly returned them, they could bind their souls together for all eternity, in this life and forever beyond. The vows linked them inextricably. 'Twas said if a Keltar gave the vows, and they were not returned, he would be forever incomplete, missing a part of his heart, aching for the love of a woman he could never have, eternally bound to her, through this life and all his future existence, whether in the cycle of rebirth, heaven, hell, or even an eternal unseelie prison.
"If aught must be lost," the legendary vows began, "'twill be my life for yours."
He snorted derisively. He had no life to give. Very little left of a soul. Not much honor, either, if one wanted to go further into the oath, which he didn't.
"What?"
she asked, wondering why he'd snorted. He looked down at her, She was glancing askance up at him, her head tipped back. Her short, glossy black curls glistened beneath the hotel lights. Her creamy skin glowed with a kiss of sun gold. The lass liked the outdoors, and the expression in her eyes managed somehow to be curious, irritated, worried, and determined, all at the same time. Just looking up at him like that, she took his breath away. And he wasn't the kind of man that happened to easily. It was more than what she looked like that did it to him. It was the woman inside the lush package. Jessica St. James was a handful of a woman, precisely the kind he'd so long ago hungered to find. Scholarly, learned, she possessed spine and sauciness and independence of will. In the 9th century, it had gotten to the point where he would have positively welcomed a temper tantrum from a woman, even if it had been completely unfounded. He would have appreciated any show of backbone. But as laird of the castle since birth, and heir to the ways of druidry, virtually all he'd gotten from the lasses from a tender age on was obedience, deference, and awe.
"Aye, my lord. If it please you, my lord. How may I serve you, my lord? Is the wine to your liking, my lord? May I fetch you anything, anything at all, my lord?"
And it had only worsened as he'd aged and become a formidably powerful man, sorcerer, and warrior. He'd found himself increasingly drawn to more mature women, like this one. He suspected she had a good quarter century to her name. In his century, she would have, like as not, had 3 or 4 babes and lost a few husbands by this time in her life. He preferred women who'd lived a good bit, women whom the passage of years had deepened and made more interesting. He liked to toop, bloody hell did he ever, but he also liked to be able to talk when the tooping was at a temporary hiatus. This woman was certainly interesting, beyond his compelling, feisty and sexy and looking up at him with an enticing sheen on her plump lower lip. He ducked his head and tasted her. She was soft, silky, and utterly delectable. He nipped her lower lip gently, then brushed his mouth lightly against hers, savoring the sweet friction. He didn't push to deepen the kiss. There would be time later for scorchingly intense kisses. He contented himself for the now with a purely hedonistic, lazy taste of her. Moving soft and slow, lulling her into him. When he felt her body melting forward, he pulled away with a slow, erotic tug of her lower lip. She stared up at him with a startled, searching expression. Her lips parted, the lower one slightly puffed out. His mouth tingled from the touch. He wondered if she felt it too, wondered what she was thinking, feeling. He stretched his senses and probed, suspecting deep in his bones it wouldn't work. If voice had no effect on her, he highly doubted deep listening would. Deep listening was the druid art of reading the minds and hearts of others, and was another of his greatest skills. Nay, that wasn't quite right. He excelled at all druid skills he always had. He was an anomaly, the only Keltar ever to have been born with the full power of all of his ancestors, combined and compounded, an abnormality of nature, an anathema in an otherwise ancient, honorable, and predictable bloodline. While his da had excelled at healing, and his granda had been adept at predicting the seasons for the sowing and reaping, and his uncle had been highly skilled in both voice and alchemy, Kian had been born with all those talents 100-fold, plus abilities no Keltar had ever displayed before. 'Twas much of why he'd ended up trapped in the dark glass.
"Too much power for one man. Pull back, Cian,"
his mother used to say with troubled eyes.
"One day you'll go too far."
And indeed he had. He'd coveted the Dark Hallows himself, even knowing they bore the innately corruptive essence of black magic, and that no man could own one and remain unchanged. Still, he'd hungered, just as Lucan had, for ever greater power. But where Lucan had been perfectly willing to embrace evil, Kian's error had been that he'd arrogantly believed himself incapable of being corrupted or defeated by either man or magic. How wrong he'd been. But that was another time, a long-ago story, and one best forgotten. she was now. He opened himself, focusing his senses, probed gently at her. Nothing. He probed harder. Silence. Utter and absolute. Centering, he pounded at Jessica St. James, a battering ram at the castle gates of her mind. Not a hint of an emotion. Not a whisper of a thought. Astonishing. To test himself, he fired a questing arrow at the man arranging for the room. He flinched back hastily. The desk clerk was a miserable man. His wife had recently left him for one of his best friends. Kian swallowed, trying to scrape the foul taste of the man's despair from his tongue. Despair served no one well. He wanted to shake him and say, "Fight, you fool! Fight for her! Never cede the battle! Never yield the day!" "Dunna give up, man," Kian hissed. The desk clerk glanced up, looking startled. "You can't just let her walk away," he growled. "She's your wife." The clerk's eyes narrowed, flickered uneasily.
"Who are you? Do I know you?"
he said defensively.
"What?"
Jessica said beside him.
"What's going on?"
"Nothing. Forget it."
To the desk clerk, he said,
"Be at ease."
It wasn't his place to save the world. Well, mayhap it was, but he knew what must be done, and it wasn't this. With a soft snort of exasperation beside him, Jessica accepted a packet from the once again submissive desk clerk, twitched that sweet bottom of hers, and stalked off toward two huge burnished gold doors in the wall. She cast a glance back over her shoulder at him, and her expression could not have more clearly said, "Well, come on, you great big overbearing brute. I don't like you one bit, but we're stuck together." Kian admired the view for a moment, before picking up the mirror and loping off to join her. 20 days with this woman. Mayhap, somewhere, some divinity in which he'd not believed, believed in him. Believed he would redeem himself and was rewarding him in advance. She stopped at the doors. Yawning, she stretched her arms over her head, arched her back, and twisted from side to side as if stretching out her spine. Bloody hell, the woman was a woman in all the right places. Who cared the why of things? She was his for the next 20 days. Chapter 9. Jessie sat at the cherry writing desk in room 2112, hooking up her laptop, scowling into the small wall mirror that hung above it, wondering why hotels always put mirrors above writing desks. Who wanted to look at themselves while writing? Apparently, a lot of people must, because every hotel she'd been in had pretty much the same setup. Closet inside the door on the left, bathroom inside the door on the right, or vice versa. First bed facing a writing desk, with requisite mirror hung above it, a small table between the beds sporting clock, radio, and phone, second bed facing a TV, armoire, dresser, and at the far wall, a small table and two chairs sat before a wall of windows. This room was no different, though a cut above some she'd been in, with Merlot and champagne carpet, patterned with a gold diamond design, walls papered in textured ivory with gold embellishments at the moldings, beds topped with crisp ivory linens and champagne comforters, the windows hung with billowy wine drapes. Behind her, Kian McKelter was taking a shower, beyond the closed bathroom door. She'd closed the door. She'd also closed her eyes when he'd dropped his kilt right in front of her. Which wasn't to say that she was a prude and hadn't stared at him through the glass of the shower enclosure when she'd firmly shut the door a few moments later. She had. The moment they'd entered the hotel room, his gaze had gone instantly to the double king beds. So had hers, and there'd been one of those intensely tense moments where people either jumped on each other or got as far away from each other as they could. She'd done a little crab scuttle sideways, nearly sidling right back out into the hall. He'd smiled faintly, mockingly at her, then stepped past her and thoroughly scanned the entire room before positioning the mirror against the far wall, facing the entry door. She'd not missed that it also faced the beds. but was refusing to ponder it over long. For a moment, she'd thought he was going to kiss her again, but as he'd walked back toward her, his gaze had swept past her to the bathroom.
"Christ!" he'd exclaimed. "'Tis a modern garrobe. I couldn't see beyond the door to the one in Lucan's study, though I've seen pictures."
He'd trailed off wonderingly.
"Is that where he kept you, the mirror hung? In his study?"
How strange his existence must have been inside a mirror. She couldn't begin to fathom it.
"Aye, though I've seen most modern inventions in books, and the like in his study, I've not had the opportunity to examine the real things."
She'd been about to give him a quick demonstration, anything to get away from those beds, but he'd plunged right into things, just as he had in the car, taking command, twisting handles and turning knobs, squirting little bottles of shampoo and conditioner until the room had been a steam sauna, scented of perfumed toiletries.
"Does this hostelry contain a kitchen and serving wenches, lass?"
He'd paused long enough in his explorations to ask. She'd nodded.
"Command us a feast, woman. I'm famished. Meat. Much meat. And wine."
When he'd unfastened his wrist cuffs, she should have gotten the hint. Without further ado, he'd dropped his kilt. Had stood there, utterly unself-conscious, wearing nothing but a leather sheath strapped to one heavily muscled thigh, casing a heavily jewel-encrusted knife. Doffing that, too, he'd placed it high on the shower stall's edge and stepped beneath the spray. Pulse suddenly jumping in her throat, she'd turned sharply away and squeezed her eyes shut. She could still taste him on her lips. The kiss he'd given her in the lobby had stunned her, and scorched her right down to her toes. He'd not pushed for tongue, or tried to grab a breast the instant he'd thought he'd gotten her distracted with a kiss. No. He'd kissed her lazily, without touching her anywhere else at all, as if he had all the time in the world, brushing his firm, full, sexy lips back and forth over hers, gently sucking her lower lip. She'd actually melted into the egotistical Neanderthal, had felt her lips parting. Logic, reason, and awareness of current events had vanished from her mind as abruptly and completely as if someone had just vacuumed her brain out through her ear. It was his gentleness that had gotten her, she decided on the way up in the elevator. It had surprised her, that was all. It was just that she'd not expected such a soft touch from such a hard-bodied, aggressive man. She'd not been prepared for it, any more than she had been for him to get butt-naked in front of her. And criminy, what a butt. When she'd opened her eyes and turned back, she'd stared through the steamy glass at him, all 6½ magnificent naked feet of him. Powerful muscles shaped his long legs and massive thighs. His ass was tight, perfectly formed, and packed with more sweet muscle. She loved a good butt on a man. Too many guys had none at all. Both legs and butt were dusted with fine, silky, dark hair. He wasn't one of those lady-killer bodybuilders or models that shaved. He was a man's man and proud of it. More dark hair dusted his forearms and beneath his arms. He'd lathered himself up and begun scrubbing beneath the steamy spray. As his powerful hands moved over his body, prime, sleek muscle rippled beneath his slick, golden skin. She'd been so engrossed watching him wash himself that when he'd squirted conditioner in his hand and closed a fist around himself, she'd continued dazedly watching. Not until he'd begun to rhythmically slip his hand up and down had she realized what she was watching him do. Eyes snapping wide, she jerked her gaze to his face. His gaze had been locked on her face, his eyes narrowed, his gaze dark and hot. He'd flashed her a sexy, wicked smile that had been both invitation and challenge, catching the tip of his tongue between his teeth. She backed hastily out and slammed the door. The man was seriously hung. An insane, utterly uncaring of consequences part of her had wanted nothing more than to go right back in there, strip, get in the shower with him, push his hand away, and replace it with hers.
"Get a grip, Jesse," she'd rebuked herself firmly, "and not on Mirror Man's dick."
After shutting him in the bathroom and gulping a few steadying breaths, she'd gone to the phone and ordered room service, putting it also on her credit card.
Why not?
She muttered to her reflection over the top of her laptop.
I may as well charge with impunity.
The way things were going, she probably wouldn't live long enough to have to pay it off anyway. She made a face at herself in the mirror. It had been a long day, and she was showing signs of the strain. Her makeup was as good as gone. Her stubborn cowlicks were acting up, and her clothes were rumpled. Plucking a tissue from a box on the desk, she dabbed at the remnants of mascara smudged on her lashes and ran a hand through her short, glossy curls. People often told her she looked like a curvier version of the girl who'd played Virginia, the heroine in the Tenth Kingdom, and she supposed she did, after Virginia had gotten her hair whacked off by the Wolfman, after the gypsies had cursed her for setting their poor birds free. Jessie would have set the poor birds free, too. Not that her hair looked like it had been whacked off or anything. She got it trimmed every 6 weeks down at the Beauty Training Academy, and they did a pretty good job for $6. She narrowed her eyes at her reflection. Breasts. They were undoubtedly her best feature. Some people got great nails and hair. Some people got beautiful smiles or pretty eyes. Some people got skinny little perfect beach butts, those to